Furtado, and Friere go to get the BMW in the garage. The silver 4Runner is seen traveling at a slow rate of speed on Tremont Street, cruising past Lopez and Sanchez. The silver 4Runner then disappears from camera view around the block just minutes before the shootings, which was never caught on camera. The very next day, on Thursday, June 20th, 2013, Detective Sullivan reached out to the Massachusetts State Police handling the Odin Lloyd investigation and began what would become a cooperative effort. 3 days later, on what I liked to call Magical Monday, June 24th, 2013, investigators would hit the jackpot with several major developments. After speaking with Sullivan, the state police followed up by calling the Boston detectives that day with information about an anonymous caller who had contacted the North Attleboro police saying there was a connection between the Lloyd murder and the Boston shootings. The caller was later identified as Sharif Hashem, a manager at Cure and other nearby nightclubs. Hashem said he came across information that led him to believe Aaron Hernandez was involved in both cases. He said a frequent clubgoer told him he saw Hernandez get into a silver SUV with Rhode Island plates, which matched the description of the car involved in the Boston shootings. Hashem's information wasn't exactly conclusive, but now with the anonymous call and the fact they knew Aaron was at Cure that night in a car similar to that of the murderer, the call was just enough to put them over the threshold of having enough probable cause to start issuing search warrants and subpoenas, and issue them they did. The first thing the police did was ask First Assistant District Attorney Patrick Hagan, who was already assigned to the case and would be my main adversary throughout, to preserve all of Aaron's cell phone records, a task that might help police track his movements that night. Hagan also obtained records from the Enterprise Car Rental Company showing that Aaron had rented a car on Monday, July 16, 2012, hours after the murders. The police ran the license plates of the 4Runner Aaron was seen in while exiting the Tufts garage and found out it was registered to Jaina Leasing and Rental Corporation of Providence, Rhode Island. It was a demo model, given to Hernandez in 2012 for his use in exchange for promotional work for Fox Toyota. The owner of the dealership said he had not seen the vehicle since May 2012. Needless to say, things were piling on fast for Aaron. Now all the police needed was a murder weapon, and Magical Monday would not disappoint. Detective Sullivan put out a notice to all police agencies in the tri-state area, comprising Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, that they were looking for a gun used in a double homicide in Boston. Based on the bullets recovered at the scene, forensics were able to narrow down the possibility of the gun caliber being a 9mm, a 38, or a 357. The luck of the Irish would smile upon Detective Sullivan once more on Magical Monday, as on that very day, Massachusetts State Police responded to a red 2012 Toyota Camry involved in an accident on I-91 in Longmeadow, Massachusetts. When the vehicle was towed and examined, an unloaded Smith & Wesson 38 caliber special revolver, along with 3 rounds of ammunition, were located in an unlocked briefcase in the trunk of the car. Boston police took a sharper interest when they learned that the driver of the car, 19-year-old Jaylene Diaz Ramos, was from Bristol, Connecticut, the same hometown as Aaron. She initially told police that she gave a ride to a friend of hers and some amateur football players. Her friend, who went by the name Chicago, had left the case in her car without her knowledge after she gave him and some of his buddies a ride. The gun was soon transferred to the Boston Police Firearms Analysis Unit and examined by Detective Camper, who would issue a report stating that the gun recovered from the Bristol resident Jaylene Diaz Ramos was in fact the same gun used to kill Saphiro Furtado and Daniel De Abreu. With the investigation now in high gear, 2 days later on June 26, 2013, a search warrant was executed for 114 Lake Avenue in Bristol, Connecticut. During a search of the property, a silver Toyota 4Runner with Rhode Island license plate 635035 was found in a locked garage. It was covered in dust and cobwebs, and the battery was dead. This house would become extremely significant because police would later identify Chicago as John Alcorn, a childhood friend of Diaz Ramos. Alcorn had once listed this house as his mailing address because his cousin Thaddeus Singleton lived there. Thaddeus, also known as T.L. Singleton, was the husband of Tanya Cummings Singleton, the cousin of Aaron Hernandez. Diaz Ramos would later change her story to say that she purchased the gun from a person named Flacco in Springfield, Massachusetts, but that didn't matter much to police, They preferred her original story. 2 days later, Boston police returned to take possession of the car. Detective Sullivan was joined by Detective Peter Dauphineas of the Bristol Police Department. Dauphineas was familiar with Hernandez's family and the friends he hung out with. Sullivan showed Dauphineas photographs from the video taken of Hernandez and Bradley during the night at Cure. "I know that guy," Dauphineas said. The detective had immediately recognized Bradley, who sometimes went by his middle name Sherrod. Bradley, who was 30 at the time of the Boston shootings, was a native of Hartford, Connecticut, and the father of 3 children by different women, and also known by police to be involved in drugs and guns. Getting Bradley's name was a huge break for the police, especially after Bradley agreed to speak with them under a proffer agreement, which allows individuals under criminal investigation to give their knowledge of crimes with the supposed assurance that their words will not be used against them in any later proceedings. He was later given full immunity. Bradley appeared to be gold for investigators and the prosecution. His detailed account of the morning of July 16, 2012, fingered Aaron Hernandez as the trigger man for the Boston shootings. During interviews and testimony before a grand jury, Bradley said Hernandez came to his apartment in Manchester, Connecticut, to pick him up with plans of going to a nightclub in Boston. Bradley said that as they were about to get into a silver Toyota 4Runner, Hernandez raised the hood and put a gun somewhere in the engine. After arriving at Cure Lounge, Bradley said he and Hernandez were standing at the bar when an unknown male bumped into the football player, causing him to spill his drink on Hernandez. Bradley described the unknown male as 5'10", light-skinned, with long braids, basically describing Daniel de Abreu. Hernandez allegedly became angry, saying, "I hate when people try me." After Bradley and Hernandez left the club, Bradley said they stopped at another bar before going back to the garage where the 4Runner was parked. He told police that 2 men matching the description of Abreu and Sanchez followed them to the other bar and were staring them down, laughing at them. Bradley told police that this infuriated Hernandez to the point that they had to leave the bar because Hernandez felt they were trying him. After exiting the club, Bradley said they got the 4Runner and left the garage. But it wasn't long before Hernandez, who was driving, pulled over to the curb, jumped out of the SUV, opened the hood, and retrieved the gun from the engine compartment and put it in the glove compartment inside the car. Hernandez told Bradley to drive. In the 4Runner, they circled the area for a bit, then pulled over and got out to try and pick up girls during the letout. A few minutes later, Hernandez said, "There they go, right there. Let's go, let's go." Bradley said he saw a BMW and assumed that was where Hernandez wanted to go. They both jumped in the 4Runner, Bradley pressing the accelerator to the floorboard. Bradley said he ran a red light before pulling up to the passenger side of the BMW, which was stopped at the intersection of Harold Street and Shawmut Avenue. According to Bradley, Hernandez took the gun out of the glove box and told him, "Watch out," and "Sit back." Hernandez then leaned across Bradley's body and extended his arm out the driver's window. Bradley stated Hernandez said, "Yo, what's up now, niggas?" and started shooting, firing 6 shots and emptying the chamber. He could hear the clicking of the gun after all the bullets were used. When the attack ended, Bradley said he was told to drive away from the scene while Hernandez checked the GPS on his cell phone for directions. "Did you see that? I got one of them in the head and one in the chest," Hernandez bragged, according to Bradley. Several minutes later, while on the Massachusetts Turnpike, Bradley said he told Hernandez that he needed to get rid of the gun. So Hernandez opened the chamber on the revolver and dropped the casings from the gun out of the window. Bradley then said that Aaron took his shirt off to wipe down the gun. Bradley said that while driving down the turnpike, Hernandez later threw the gun out of the window into a heavily wooded area. The two wound up in Hartford, Connecticut, at the home of Brooke Wilcox, Bradley's girlfriend at the time. It was there, Bradley said, that Hernandez used a laptop to search the internet for news of a double homicide in Boston, and also placed a phone call to Tanya Cummings Singleton. No one in the Hernandez extended family had been more loyal to Aaron than Tanya. He considered her his best friend and confidant. Bradley said Hernandez's cousin arrived at Wilcox's home in a white Nissan Maxima. After speaking with Hernandez, Tanya left the Nissan Maxima and took the Toyota 4Runner. Bradley said Hernandez told him that Singleton took the car to clean and hide it. Bradley admitted his relationship with Hernandez soured after that, to the point where he accused his former friend of shooting him in the face 7 months later in February 2013. The Boston shootings were now solved. All cops and prosecutors had to do was wait their turn as Bristol County prosecutors tried and convicted Aaron for the murder of Odin Lloyd. With all of the video evidence, murder weapon, and Bradley's testimony, the case against Hernandez for the Boston shootings was a slam-dunk conviction, and Boston police would have nabbed themselves a fallen patriot. Chapter 5. The Not-So-Anonymous Call. Early on in the case, we had a team meeting in Boston. We brought the entire trial team together for the first time so I could bring everyone up to date on the facts of the case, give an overview, and explain to each team member what the defense strategy would be based on what we knew at that time. I had put together what I believe could very well be the best defense team ever assembled. They say O.J. Simpson had a dream team, but Aaron's legal team was built for speed and precision. As an attorney and student of the game, I love working with great lawyers. They make me step up my game, my skill set improves, and I always walk away a better lawyer. This time, I would be working with an attorney I had been waiting 5 years to partner up with, Harvard Law Professor Ronald S. Sullivan, Jr. Sully is the Dean of Faculty at Harvard Law School and runs the Harvard Law School Criminal Justice Initiative. I met Ron when he invited me to teach at Harvard's Trial Advocacy Workshop, or TAW, as it is known at the law school. TAW is a hands-on course in which second- and third-year law students take a fictional case and try it, from its inception to its closing, with the help of professors and faculty pulled together from throughout the country. The mock trial is an enriching experience not only for the students, but for the faculty as well. The faculty gets together and exchanges ideas, and you get to see other styles. It's an important part of my year. I always enjoy getting away, going to Cambridge, and focusing on trial advocacy for a week or two in an environment that lives and breathes trials. Sully is a constitutional scholar and an expert in criminal law. He's a rare breed of lawyer, not only well-versed in the law, but also street smart, which proves a deadly combination. I was eager to work with someone like that. As a team, I always felt we would complement each other well. As third chair, I brought in Linda Kenny Bodden, with whom I had consulted on the Casey Anthony trial, a mother accused of killing her 2-year-old daughter. While Linda did not try Casey's case with us, I was extremely impressed with her knowledge of forensics. Linda has for many years served as a mentor to me, teaching me various skills, and she's always on top of the latest in forensic science. She's now a friend. I call her Mom. Linda suggested that we bring in a local lawyer, George Leontire. I had met George and his partner several years earlier at a birthday party for Linda's husband, the preeminent forensic pathologist, Dr. Michael Bodden, whose HBO show Autopsy was a favorite of mine. I had never worked with George and was very hesitant, having been burned in the past by bringing in people I didn't know to other high-profile cases. Lesson number one is be careful who you bring in. But I trusted Linda. So after much prodding and suggesting by my trial mother, George Leontire joined the team, and I am glad he did. George was a tremendous asset. We never would have pulled it off without him. We would also have numerous lawyers and law students assisting us. Early on, I knew this team would be epic. The first thing I do whenever I look at a case is to start reading the police reports, because the prosecutor's case always aligns with the investigation. I don't know how other lawyers do it, but that's what I do. I find that prosecutors employ very little creativity when they prepare their strategy because the cops, from the inception of the investigation, develop a case in one direction, letting one clue lead to the next, and the prosecutor always follows. If a prosecutor comes up with an alternate theory of the crime, then the police ultimately become defense witnesses and can be easily impeached. As I began to review the police reports on my computer, I was eager to see how Aaron's case developed. And one of the things that really jump-started the investigation was that anonymous call. The call was of considerable concern to me because it meant that either Aaron confessed to someone, despite having told me he was innocent, or there was a witness to the crime somewhere out there. Typically, anonymous calls come in when someone sees something, is personally involved, or overheard something. Long story short, we needed to find this guy. This case had over 30,000 pages of discovery, which means police reports, witness statements, and forensic findings. I hadn't finished reading all of it when I noticed the police had begun to identify Sharif Hashem, an employee of Cure Lounge, as the anonymous caller. The reports never pointed out how they knew it was him. Reports just said the caller was later identified as Sharif Hashem. After our first team meeting, getting more information about Hashem was on everyone's mind. As a defense attorney, I like to get out in the field. I want to see where everything happened. I like to see, feel, and touch the case and its important places of interest. So I suggested to Sully that we go out to Cure that night. It was a Saturday night. Trial lawyers need fun too, I said. Sully and I decided to meet there and bring along one of our investigators just in case we needed to document something. I was coming from Dartmouth, about 45 minutes outside of Boston, so I was about 20 minutes behind Sully. When Sully arrived, he decided to wait outside until I got there. Suddenly, he heard a voice calling out to him. Professor! He ignored it. Then it got louder. Professor! Great, now I am going to have to explain to one of my students what the hell I'm doing at a nightclub on a Saturday night, thought Sully, who was a married man and father of two. As he turned around to acknowledge the voice, he saw a familiar face, but he just couldn't place it. He knew the man was from Harvard, but how did they know each other? Then it hit him. This was the IT guy from the law school. His name was none other than Sharif Hashem. Sully is no dummy, so he struck up a conversation with him, and while he's speaking to him, he texts me and tells me that he's outside speaking to Sharif. And this is when my foot hits the gas. I arrive minutes later to not only find Sully speaking to Sharif, but he's also speaking to another man, a short, stocky black man in his late 50s, who I recognize as a Cure employee from the surveillance tapes we were given during discovery. He clearly stood out because of his weight, age, and the distinct hat he wore. It was one of those fedoras, the kind detectives in the 50s used to wear, like Dick Tracy. I was surprised to hear him introduced to me as Miller Thomas, Cure's director of security. My adrenaline began to kick into high gear. I remember thinking, wow, this is amazing that they are willing to speak to us so freely. Usually, witnesses are extremely reluctant to talk to defense lawyers, especially when a business like Cure is involved. People have this incredible fear of defense lawyers, like we are going to sue them or something if they step out of line and say something they shouldn't. Yet the truth is the truth. It takes no sides, and the truth is never actionable. Put simply, just tell us what happened, and there's not a damn thing anybody can do to you. Moments after I arrived, Miller Thomas walked away to take care of some of his duties. Sully then asked Sharif to share with me what he had told him. His was a jaw-dropping tale, to say the least. He told us that on June 21st, 2013, Detectives Hall Brewster and Craig Jones, both from the Boston Police Department, were at Cure serving a subpoena and began to speak with Hashem. Hashem was well known to Boston police. He was the go-to guy when they needed information on criminal activity involving nightclubs and liquor establishments in the area. They often asked Hashem to provide video footage or customer and employee information when such crimes occurred. While Hashem was speaking to the detectives, someone known to Hashem simply as either B or G walked up and told him there was a connection between the Odin Lloyd murder and the Boston shootings and implicated Aaron Hernandez. Hashem described the conversation this way. He said something to the sense of, "Well, it's not his first time," referring to the Odin Lloyd case. "What do you mean by that?" Hashem asked. "Well, you know he probably did it because he got away with murder before." "What are you talking about?" Hashem asked. "Remember the incident where two people got shot up in a car? Two Cape Verdean kids got shot up in a car by Cure last summer?" Hashem said, "Yes, I remember hearing about that incident." "Well, I was outside getting into my car, and I saw Hernandez get into a silver SUV with Rhode Island plates, and after that they said that was the car involved in the shooting, and I also heard both shootings are connected." After this B or G guy left, Hashem said he turned to Detective Jones and asked him what he thought of that. Hashem then told us that Jones just stared and didn't say a word. That might sound plausible on the surface, but it doesn't really make sense. Two homicide detectives are talking to Hashem, and this B or G guy is going to interrupt them and all of a sudden have this conversation? The detectives get a lead on the highest profile murder case in the state and potentially have a lead to solve a double murder, and they don't say a word to this B or G guy? Or interrupt B or G and start to ask him any questions, like his name? What else does he know? Instead of doing a report or following up on the lead, they just tell Hashem, "You may want to call that in." Hashem didn't really know this B or G guy. He described him as about 5'7", about 170 pounds, clean-cut, dark-skinned, and probably of Cape Verdean, Haitian, or Dominican descent. "He's not a person that I have first-hand knowledge of, but he's an unusually nice person that just comes to the club, and I talk to him on the way in, and I talk to him on the way out," Hashem explained. He's not there every week, but maybe I see him once a month, once every other month. The next day, June 22, 2013, Hashem got a call from a supervising detective, Michael Talbot, telling him that he should tell the homicide detectives what he heard. Hashem assumed Detective Jones must have told Talbot about the conversation with B or G, and that's why Talbot called. So Hashem dutifully made his anonymous call to the tip line and linked Aaron Hernandez to the Boston shooting. In order to understand the significance of the not-so-anonymous call, you have to remember that up to this point, all the cops had was that Aaron was at Cure that night and he drove a similar silver SUV. That meant nothing. There's a boatload of those in Boston, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. It's a very common car. None of it means Aaron was involved in any way, shape, or form. What the cops needed was a connection to the murder, and to establish that, they needed more evidence. What they needed was to get several search warrants to investigate Aaron's home, examine his cars, and seize his telephone records. But before police can do that, they need to convince a judge that they have probable cause. The law provides that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Oh yes, that pesky little thing called the Constitution and law enforcement's archenemy, the Fourth Amendment. So for a judge to sign a warrant allowing them to search Aaron's house and cell phone records, they had to show he had opportunity, that he was there, and that he was driving a car similar to what the witnesses said they saw near the shooting. But even that wasn't enough to get a warrant. Many people were at Cure that night, and I am sure a few of them, or people near the area, drove similar vehicles. What they needed was a connection to the shooting, something that pointed the finger squarely at Aaron Hernandez. What they needed was B or G. As outrageous as it sounds, I believe the cops staged this whole encounter with B or G for Sharif Hashem. They knew Sharif was a gullible, cop-friendly kind of guy. So they staged this conversation in order to get him to make the anonymous call and give them the missing link they needed to obtain warrants and get the ball rolling in the investigation. Of course, once Aaron was indicted, the police never found this B or G guy, who knew so much about everything that happened. After his innocuous conversation with Sharif, he was never seen again at Cure, or anywhere else for that matter. This tells me one of two things. He's either a cop working undercover at the club about once a month to see if there are any drugs being bought or sold there, or he's a confidential informant cops know was frequenting the club, and the cops have him in their pocket to the point where they can say, "We want to leak that Aaron Hernandez was involved in the shooting," and he goes and does it. My money is B or G is a cop, but we will never know. What's also telling is the way Hashem sounded when he made his anonymous call a year after the shootings in Boston. Anonymous: how you doing, sir? Dispatch: good. Anonymous: I was wondering if I could leave you an anonymous tip that might help you with an ongoing investigation. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: okay. On July 15, I think, of 2012. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: yeah, that was, I believe, a Sunday night into a Monday morning. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: yeah, it was the 15th. Dispatch: July 16, 2012, you're saying, right? Anonymous: July 15, sir. Dispatch: 15th, okay. Anonymous: oh, yeah, so yeah, it would be the 16th because it was around 2:30 a.m. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: yeah, there was a shooting in Boston that killed two people. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: yeah, two people died near the south end, near the bridge by the turnpike from 2:30 in the morning. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: yeah, and, I believe the people were just talking about an SUV with Rhode Island plates. Dispatch: okay. Anonymous: yeah, and I believe that this might be related to the ongoing investigation in Northern Attleboro right now, the Odin Lloyd murder. Dispatch: okay. All right, just because of the description of the vehicle, or do you believe it has something to do with the, person of interest? It was widely reported Aaron was the person of interest in the killing of Odin Lloyd. Or whatever is going on? Anonymous: both. Dispatch: both? Anonymous: yes. Dispatch: both. Okay. All right. Now, without giving your name, Do you know anyone who's an acquaintance type of thing that knows or heard something said about it? Anonymous. I also don't like to get more involved. I think it's the right thing to do by giving you that information. Dispatch. Okay, no, I understand. Obviously, I'll pass it down to them to look into it. But I just wanted to know if there was more of a background stuff, you know, to differentiate anything behind it. Like if you heard from various group of people or certain without giving me your name. Anonymous. Yeah, it's exactly. Dispatch. Okay. Anonymous. I think somebody might have accidentally spilled the beans in front of me. Dispatch. Okay. Anonymous. You know, as a society, we can't have 3 homicides. Dispatch. No. Anonymous. And you know, not do anything about it. Dispatch. Okay. All right. So that was July 15th into the 16th. Anonymous. Yeah. Dispatch. About 2:30 a.m. in South Boston. Anonymous. No. South End. Dispatch. South End near the turnpike, right? Anonymous. Yeah, you know where the bridge is? Dispatch. Yep. Anonymous. It's like where Area 1 in Boston ends and District 4 begins. Dispatch. Okay. Anonymous. By that tower over there. Dispatch. Okay. Anonymous. Yeah. Dispatch. All right, so... Anonymous. So, it's like you remember the... I don't know if you remember that, probably, because... Dispatch. A lot of the stuff, unfortunately, the news, referring to Aaron Hernandez in the news, every night there's something on there, so, but I will definitely pass that on. Anonymous. Yep. Dispatch. And hopefully they will look into it and go from there. Anonymous. You know, I wish you guys all the best and good luck. Dispatch. All right, thank you very much. Anonymous. Thank you very much for all that you guys do, sir. Dispatch. Bye-bye. Anonymous. Bye. The 3 things that stand out to me when I look at this call transcript are, first, that he remembered the exact date over a year later. I think it's fair to say that a lot happened to Hashem in that year, and to remember the exact date of the shootings is an odd coincidence. Second, that he says he thinks somebody accidentally spilled the beans in front of him. This is clearly puzzling because the way Sharif describes it, nobody accidentally spilled anything. He had an open, direct conversation with B or G. He didn't happen to overhear another private conversation. This part makes me question Sharif's version of events. Third, he describes the location of the shootings as where Area 1 in Boston ends and District 4 begins. He's referring to police districts. Even with all of the contact Hashem has with law enforcement, I seriously doubt that any security guard or systems analyst has any clue where the lines between different police districts are. The detail regarding the police district location could have come only from a police officer. One trying to ensure the anonymous call would be forwarded to the right department as soon as possible. Sharif was an interesting character. I could never figure him out, because he was so open with us that I felt he was telling the truth. Yet some of his story didn't make any sense. What I really think is that probably the bulk of what he told us was the truth, but he was also trying to protect the cops in his strange, misguided way at the same time. Deep down, he just kind of wanted to be helpful to everyone. The other notably peculiar behavior was how he handed us off to Miller Thomas, the director of security, without giving him any caution whatsoever. Shortly after Sharif was done telling us his fantastic tale, and as soon as I was done picking my jaw off the ground, Thomas walked back over to us and Sharif told him to show us around. Now remember, I arrived a little late, so I had no idea what Sully had discussed with them before I arrived, and I didn't have an opportunity to ask Sully when I got there. So Miller Thomas then escorted us into the club, bypassing all of the lines like Aaron did on that fateful night. He then began what I can only describe as a boring VIP tour of Cure. He began to show us every inch of the club as if we were going to buy the place. He showed us the bathrooms, the exits, behind the bar, and so on. I was particularly interested in the back room, where I had read Aaron had gone that night to take a picture with a fan, so he showed us that area as well. He also began pointing out all of the cameras. I could not have been more impressed with Miller Thomas. I was amazed that Thomas, a retired homicide detective and the former president of the detectives' union, had taken on this private gig working for a club where perhaps something happened in the biggest murder case in Boston since Lizzie Borden, and he had no qualms about showing us, Aaron's lawyers, around every inch of the place and answering all our questions like it was nothing. I was under the impression that Sharif had told Thomas who we were, so I asked a simple question. Are all of these cameras in the same place as the day of the incident? What incident? Thomas asked. That was when my heart began to race, and I realized he had no clue who we were. I guess Thomas thought we were either some kind of VIP Sharif knew, or friends of Sharif's or the owner's. Thomas's demeanor changed instantly after Sully chimed in and told him we were Aaron's lawyers. Thomas immediately walked away, but he didn't go far. He literally stood 10 feet from us for the rest of the night. We decided to stay and have a drink to discuss what we had just found out, while Thomas stood nearby staring at us like a jealous boyfriend. Sully and I could not get over how awkward it was with him standing there staring at us. "This is weird," I told Sully. "Tell me about it," he responded. I looked over at Thomas and met his gaze and quipped, "Do you think he'll leave if we start dancing?" Sully and I had a good laugh and decided we had seen enough. As we walked outside and stopped on the sidewalk near the entrance, we noticed Miller Thomas follow us out, wearing his Dick Tracy hat and trench coat. I looked at Sully and said, "I swear you can't make this shit up." Right then and there, I knew we were going to have to keep digging and rattle some cages, because Thomas was extremely nervous, and it really shouldn't have been easy to rattle this experienced retired homicide detective. What was he hiding? Was he covering something up for the club? His cop buddies? Little did I know that we would get at least some of those questions answered, and a hell of a lot more. Chapter 6. A Video Game Called Motive. Before I got involved with the case, I remember seeing in the news that the double murder in Boston began with a spilled drink. The motive fell perfectly within the storyline. This hothead jock, Aaron Hernandez, became enraged when Daniel De Abreu spilled a drink on him. He was so angry, he retaliated by unloading a gun on him and his friends, killing Abreu and Zafiro Furtado, and injuring Aquilino Friere. I think if you were to poll everyone who knows anything about this case, that is exactly what they would tell you. All this happened over a spilled drink. Never mind the fact that a spilled drink causing murder seems absurd, and the fact that Aaron would have been risking millions in his perfect life. You still have Aaron, at a hulking 6'2", 265 pounds, against Daniel De Abreu, who was 5'7" and 170 pounds soaking wet. Aaron would have destroyed Abreu with his bare hands. He didn't have to lie in wait for 2.5 hours and then gun him down on a street corner. You can't ignore common sense like that. Even if Aaron were the hottest of hotheads, the fact is, he would have pounced on him then and there. Aaron was never shy about getting into fights before this incident, and even after. This motive just does not make any sense. Where did the story originate? That distinct honor would be attributed to the Commonwealth's star witness and informant, Alexander Bradley. Once he mentioned the spilled drink motive to prosecutors in court during a pretrial hearing, it stuck, and now everyone refers to the double murder case in Boston as the spilled drink case. So naturally, the first thing I wanted to see when joining the case was the video. After all, isn't that everyone's instinctive reaction when trying to understand things? The why? Having a client caught in the act on video is every defense lawyer's worst nightmare. Video evidence is the only thing a good lawyer cannot overcome. There is very little a lawyer can say at that point except to deliver the famous Groucho Marx line, "Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?" The Boston case against Aaron Hernandez was always described as a video case, yet it was anything but. True, the video of Cure Lounge on the night of the shootings a year earlier was the thing that reminded Detective Sullivan that Aaron was in Cure. But how police got that video and what was actually on it was a different story altogether. Cops and prosecutors had one big, glaring problem. This so-called spilled drink incident was not on any video. It was missing. One had to ask, did it even exist? Prosecutors were saying that police could only obtain outdoor video of the club that night. The only interior video they had was of the front door and a video ID scanner the club used to capture the ID of everyone who walked through the door. So to convince a jury that a spilled drink was enough to spark Aaron Hernandez into a murderous rage, prosecutors were going to have to rely on the word of their drug-dealing snitch, Alexander Bradley, because no one else saw it. I needed to take a close look at what video evidence they actually did have in order to understand why they didn't have the biggest missing link to the case so far. Whenever any kind of video evidence exists, the first thing I like to do is look at the chain of custody. Let me explain chain of custody and how that all works. Chain of custody is an evidentiary requirement for court. You may notice if you watch trials that sometimes prosecutors put on an incredibly boring series of witnesses before they finally open an evidence bag and show what's inside. All of that testimony helps them trace the chain of custody for that item. Basically, a prosecutor must be able to account for the whereabouts of a piece of evidence from the moment it is collected all the way through to the trial. That way, the defense can't argue that the evidence was tampered with and or that it's not in the same condition it was in on the night of the crime. You may recall that during the O.J. Simpson murder trial, O.J.'s blood was everywhere and the DNA results were damning. Barry Scheck, one of Simpson's lawyers, did not challenge the validity of the DNA results. What he did challenge was the collection of the evidence and its weaknesses in the chain of custody. Everyone knows the saying, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Well, the same theory and approach apply here. So I went looking to answer the basic question, which was where did this video come from? Is there more? The first place I looked was in the evidence log to see when the video was logged into evidence, along with any other items of evidence collected in the case. To my surprise, not a single piece of video evidence was ever logged into evidence. I remember mumbling to myself aloud in front of my computer when I discovered this. Oh my God, they don't have chain of custody. Now I was the one carrying an ace up my sleeve. The question was, when was I going to use it? At trial? Let them think they were going to introduce the video, then object under chain of custody grounds? No. The problem with that approach was there was no guarantee the judge would follow the law. He might give them a break in the proceedings in order to try and prove it up. The other option was to file a pretrial motion and get the judge to rule in advance on whether he would exclude any video because the prosecutor couldn't verify chain of custody. The problem with that approach was I was dealing with a police department that I already knew had probably created an anonymous call. How hard would it be to create chain of custody for the videos? No, I decided the best option was to keep digging and see what other nuggets I could find. Later on, while reading through the more recent police reports, I found a gem written by the ever-interesting Detective Talbot. What's important to remember is that until now I had been looking at the earliest records on file because all of the collection of evidence was done in the summer of 2012. Back then, there was very little discussion of the video or its chain of custody. But on October 1st, 2013, months after Magic Monday, and after Aaron Hernandez was implicated in the double murder in Boston, Detective Talbot penned his first report on the case against Aaron Hernandez, and he thoroughly explained his actions in collecting the video evidence. On July 17, 2012, the day after Daniel De Abreu and Safiro Furtado were gunned down, Sergeant Detective Mark Sullivan began issuing assignments to various detectives in his squad. One of those assignments required getting the video from Cure Lounge. That duty fell upon Detective Talbot, the same detective who would press Sharif Hashem to make the not-so-anonymous call. The problem was Detective Talbot's name was not mentioned in any of the early reports describing how the video was obtained. In fact, the video was barely mentioned at all, other than it was picked up approximately a week after the shootings. His new report describing his activities, which was penned over a year and 3 months later, was shocking. Talbot wrote that upon being given this assignment by Sullivan, he immediately called his old friend Sharif Hashem. Yep, the same Sharif Hashem who made the anonymous call to the police. Since 2008, Hashem had worked with law enforcement and detectives in that division numerous times, delivering video surveillance for them. Talbot also knew that Hashem was a computer expert who managed all the video systems for Cure and its sister clubs. Talbot even knew Hashem was employed by Harvard University as a programming supervisor. Detective Talbot wrote that on July 16, 2012, I did contact Sharif Hashem and requested any and all video, interior and exterior, from Cure Nightclub. Sharif stated that he would handle it and call me back when the video was obtained. Sharif Hashem called me back and advised that he was still working on it and would get back to me the following day. I inquired if the video system was working properly, and he advised it was working and a copy would be made. Talbot then goes on to write that 2 days later he got a call from none other than Dick Tracy himself, Miller Thomas. He states that Thomas called him on his cell, which he found odd because he never gave Thomas his cell number. He then goes on to write, "This call was unusual because since he became the manager of record for Cure Lounge, I try to limit my interaction with him. I personally know Miller Thomas because he was a Boston police homicide detective and former president of the detectives union. Due to his prior employment, I have always tried to avoid dealing with him professionally at Cure Lounge to avoid any allegations of favoritism. Immediately, my antennae went up. Police deal with security guards and private investigators all the time. An overwhelming number of them are former law enforcement. I could not understand for the life of me why Talbot would avoid dealing with one of his own, someone he could trust. As I continued reading Talbot's report, it appeared to me that maybe he didn't trust Miller Thomas as much as I thought he did. Talbot then writes that Thomas began to question him about the relevance of any video and began to ask Talbot about the underlying homicide investigation. Talbot says he advised Thomas to direct his questions to Detective Sullivan. Okay, so now I know there's definitely some beef here between Talbot and Thomas because this is way too much information to include in a report. And at the time, this was not a high-profile case. What would have been the harm in giving a former colleague some information that might better assist him in helping him? It made no sense. They didn't have any suspects, so sharing information would not have helped anyone flee or get away with anything. In fact, all the cops knew at this time was that the victims were in the club partying before the shooting, and Talbot could have easily said, "We just want to see what they were doing in the club and see if they had any fights or disagreements with anyone." Where's the harm in saying that? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. There's more to it than that, I kept thinking to myself. Then Thomas writes to Talbot requesting a letter from law enforcement with an explanation as to why they need the video and a receipt to prove that Cure complied and gave them the video. Talbot informed Thomas that this was an odd request and that out of the hundreds of prior requests when detectives had gotten video from Cure, they never had to write a letter explaining why they needed the video. It was at this point that Talbot told Thomas to call Detective Sullivan. The next day, Talbot received a call from Detective Sullivan telling him the video was ready to be picked up. Talbot, along with Detective Arthur Hall Brewster, the same detective present when Sharif spoke to B or G from the not-so-anonymous call, and another detective went to retrieve the video. Now here is where I start to get really paranoid. It takes three detectives to go and retrieve a video? And then this video never gets logged into evidence? What the hell is going on here? Talbot says it is only then that Miller Thomas tells him the club only had video from the exterior cameras and that the interior cameras were not working. When Talbot confronts Thomas with the fact that Sharif Hashem had previously told him, when he initially made the request, that all cameras were working, Thomas responds by telling him Sharif was mistaken. The three detectives leave Cure allegedly with footage of only the exterior cameras. Talbot concludes his report by saying one last peculiar thing in probably the most peculiar police report I have ever read by saying, "I did direct Detective Hall Brewster to give the video to Sergeant Detective Sullivan. At no time did any of the Area A1 personnel view the contents of the video." There is only one reason Talbot would write that fact in there, and that was to distance himself or his detectives from this video debacle. None of them saw the video. The three detectives were simply errand boys. The first thing we decided to do was to start asking for more information on the video. We asked for the receipt Talbot gave Miller for the video. Wouldn't you know that neither the police nor Cure could produce a copy of the receipt? It was as if it never happened. Next, we asked to inspect the video equipment to get a better understanding of how the system worked. The day before we were to go and inspect the system at Cure, the prosecutor, Pat Hagen, called me with some interesting information. Apparently, Cure was now changing its story. They were claiming the police initially requested only the exterior cameras, not the interior cameras, and by the time the police made the second request, the DVRs had already recorded over what had been previously recorded. Now I knew we were onto something big. When people start changing their stories midstream, something's up. This prompted another field trip to meet with Sharif, so Sully and I set up a meeting with him at Starbucks across the street from Harvard Law School. We asked Sharif point blank, "What exactly did Talbot request?" Sharif told us Talbot requested the usual, which he took to mean all cameras, including the interior. He had absolutely no recollection of Talbot asking only for the exterior footage, and said he would have found it odd because everyone, including the bouncers who drove up to the scene immediately after, knew the victims in the BMW had been inside Cure moments earlier. The police stood by the assertion that they had requested all cameras, not just the exterior cameras. That did not surprise me one bit, because once the police put something in a report, it would take an act of Congress to get them to change it. So what really happened to the interior video footage of that night? There are really only two possibilities. Just have a look at each party's motive. Not Aaron's motive, which the video allegedly depicted, but these two dueling parties, the cops and Cure. What is Cure's motive for this video to disappear? Well, drug dealing is prevalent in nightclubs. It is a major problem. Alexander Bradley is a drug dealer. So was Bradley or someone else dealing drugs inside Cure that night? If drug dealing were discovered, then Miller Thomas's job would not only be at risk, but the club would undoubtedly get shut down in a minute, and it could say goodbye to its liquor license forever. So clearly, if the video showed drug dealing, Cure had a motive to bury it. What's the cop's motive to lie? That's a simple one. If the video does not show Aaron interacting with Daniel De Abreu, their whole motive goes bye-bye. So does their case, because the absence of a spilled drink would prove unequivocally that Bradley was lying. It would have been devastating to the Commonwealth's case. What evidence is there the cops would bury the video? The lack of a chain of custody is a big indicator. Then there is the timing of Talbot's report. The date on his report is October 1st, 2013. That's a year and a half after the shooting. It was also the week that Bradley turned state's evidence against Aaron. Were cops tossing evidence that didn't mesh with what Bradley was saying? To my mind, the most suspicious thing cops did was something they didn't do. With the exception of Paige Aiello, the blonde woman who was talking to Daniel De Abreu that night, the police did not speak to a single patron present at Cure that night. Now, I was not surprised that at the beginning of the investigation, they didn't go out of their way to question the people present. In 2012, this was just a case about two dead black immigrants on the side of the road. No one was going to be putting up any roadblocks or some great manhunt here. This kind of apathetic investigation is common throughout the United States when victims of crime are people of color. Cops do next to nothing to investigate their cases. The moment an NFL football player was suspected of being involved, however, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts spared no expense in its prosecution and law enforcement investigation. Detectives flew all the way across the country multiple times to talk to certain witnesses and deliver subpoenas they would never use. Before Aaron was a suspect, the initial investigation yielded approximately 670 pages of police reports, and most of those were transcripts from interviews in the grand jury proceedings. After Aaron was accused, the number would jump to more than 34,000 documents and several hundred hours of audio and video. To say the investigation got a steroid shot in the arm would be a gross understatement. I would estimate the investigation and prosecution of Aaron Hernandez cost the Commonwealth somewhere in the $3 million range. The point being that considering all the time and money invested as the police scrambled to find anything to corroborate Alexander Bradley's story, you would think they would have gone looking for as many people as possible who were there that night and asked if anyone saw an altercation between Daniel De Abreu and Aaron Hernandez, a clearly recognizable figure. The omission is even more glaring when you consider the statements of Cure security guard Jamie Furtado, who saw all seven men enter the club around the same time. He told police that moments later, a Patriots fan walked up and asked if he could have access to the back room so he could take a photo with Aaron Hernandez. The man had immediately spotted Hernandez and requested a photo, which Aaron politely declined. But then the guy told him it was his birthday. Aaron relented and said, "Fine, but let's do it in the back area. I don't want anyone else asking for one." Jamie Furtado told the police that the fan and Aaron were escorted to the back area, where Furtado took a picture with the man's cell phone. Not long after that, Furtado saw Aaron leaving Cure. This lead was huge, but the cops never asked for any details about the Patriots fan. The photo on his phone could have shown whether Aaron had spilled a drink on his clothing. The timestamp on the photograph could have also given them a time frame for Aaron's movements. Police already knew Aaron was only in the club for 9 minutes. The photo would have taken a good chunk of that time, and in the absence of video evidence, could have given law enforcement a critical understanding of what occurred that night. Another important fact not to be overlooked is that it should not have been hard for them to find this man. The police had the video of all people entering Cure that night and the time they arrived. Even better, they had the video of the ID scanner, which showed the driver's license or ID of everyone who entered the club. The fan photo may have been missing at that point, but its existence told us a lot, and the cops did not want to go looking for anyone who could tell them what happened inside Cure during those 9 minutes. This loose end was going to come back to haunt them. The spilled drink incident never happened. The day would come when we would be able to prove it. Chapter 7. Making of a Murder Weapon. There are people who become extremely angry when my clients are acquitted. Their frustration is unlike anything else I've ever seen. They may not even have known the alleged victims, but media coverage makes them feel like they did, so they dedicate untold time and energy to venting their frustration. But no one expresses the same frustration over the suffering of the innocent man. A man who has been beaten, sodomized, and incarcerated, possibly held for years on death row, for a crime he did not commit. No one weeps for him. No one demands accountability from those responsible for his wrongful incarceration, and no one seeks out the real killer. That's why, as a defense attorney, tracking every point of evidence and connecting the who, how, and why of a case is vital. Locating a murder weapon and linking it to a suspect is gold for homicide detectives. It answers the element of how in a murder case. If there are fingerprints and DNA on a gun that match a suspect, and ballistics show the bullets in the shooting came from the same gun, the chances of a conviction skyrocket. Without a murder weapon that directly ties to a suspect, police have to rely on eyewitnesses and circumstantial evidence to make their case. It's why the Boston police were desperate to link Aaron to a murder weapon once his name surfaced through the not-so-anonymous call about the Boston shootings. How they tried to do that is a lesson in how easy it is to convict someone through either faulty science or police misconduct. Consider the timeline. First, Aaron is linked to the Odin Lloyd shooting, which causes Detective Sullivan to remember seeing Aaron on the video at Cure Lounge on the night of the Boston shootings. Then Sharif Hashem makes his call to the tip line, naming Aaron as a suspect in the Boston shootings. Then this. 4 days after Sharif's call, Trooper Joshua Winters from the Massachusetts Police Department responds to a multiple vehicle crash on Interstate 91 near the Longmeadow, Massachusetts exit. Jaylene Diaz Ramos, a 5-foot-tall, 19-year-old Puerto Rican girl with dyed red hair, had crashed her 2012 red Toyota Camry while on the way to Six Flags to spend the day with her sister and her nieces and nephews. As a precaution, she was transported to a nearby medical center. Meanwhile, her car was towed after Trooper Winters determined there was no licensed driver to drive the car away. While Winters investigated the crash, Troopers Paul Atten and Derek Comier assisted in doing an inventory of the vehicle, during which the troopers located and unlocked a black briefcase found in the trunk of the car. It contained an unloaded silver-colored Smith & Wesson 38 revolver, along with 3 loose rounds of ammunition. Trooper Atten then transported the gun back to the barracks, where initial reports said it was logged into evidence, though that turned out not to be true. Jaylene was then arrested for failure to produce a firearm ID card. Boston police became aware of the traffic incident and the discovery of the gun, and were especially intrigued when they learned Jaylene was from Bristol and had graduated from the same high school as Aaron Hernandez. Jaylene, who was very active on social media, often posted pictures of herself and her friends. Not only did her hometown grab the attention of Boston police, but she was also a Facebook friend of Aaron's brother, DJ Hernandez. A week following the crash, Boston police received custody of the firearm and the 3 bullets. On August 1, 2013, firearms expert Tyrone Camper conducted an examination of the gun and did a test firing. His report came back saying there was a reasonable degree of certainty the gun matched the weapon used in the Boston shootings. Jaylene initially told police she had given a ride to a friend named Chicago and his buddies, a group of semi-pro football players who put their belongings in the trunk of the car. She believed one of Chicago's friends must have left the case containing the gun in her car without her knowledge. Later, after getting an immunity agreement that indicated nothing she said could be used against her, she changed her story. She told the detectives during an interview in her attorney's office that she had purchased the gun in March of 2013 from a Puerto Rican named Flaco in Springfield, Massachusetts, for $300. She said she bought the gun after being robbed and needed it for protection. The Boston cops didn't like the updated version, even though I believe it was the truth. They preferred the story that the gun belonged to Chicago, a nickname for John Alcorn, also of Bristol. Alcorn's home address was the same as T.L. Singleton's, the husband of Tanya Cummings Singleton, who happened to be a cousin of Aaron Hernandez. When we contacted Alcorn to hear his side of the story, he was pissed for being dragged into it. Alcorn, 21 at the time of the Boston shootings, grew up in Illinois and moved to Bristol when he was 14. He said he considered Jaylene to be like a sister after meeting her in 8th grade. Alcorn, a semi-pro football player, admitted he had been in Jaylene's car the day of the crash while getting a ride to work out at LA Fitness. She then drove him to work at a landscaping company. At no time did he have a gun or have knowledge of a gun, he insisted. He also said Jaylene had become afraid for her safety after an ex-boyfriend kicked in the door of her home and may have had the gun for protection. Despite the convoluted story, the police version of the way of the gun, as we called it, went like this. The trail started with Jaylene and led to Alcorn, to T.L. Singleton, to Tanya Singleton, to Aaron Hernandez. Just like that, the Boston police, who had nothing linking Aaron Hernandez to the Boston shootings less than a week earlier, had found not only an anonymous caller linking Aaron to the crime, but also the potential murder weapon, all in a case that had been stone cold for nearly a year. On the surface, the police had made several viable connections to Aaron. One would think that Boston's finest got extremely lucky, or possibly this is simply the way stupid criminals get caught all the time. But when someone's life is in your hands, it's hard to just accept what's on the surface. We really have to go where people are not willing to go to get the real answers. Most of the time, things are exactly as the police say they are. But more often than you might think, they are not. It is terrifyingly easy for someone to be nearly convicted on what appears to be solid evidence, and then the evidence turns out to be just a house of cards waiting to be blown away. I decided to back up and deconstruct the solid evidence of the murder weapon one step at a time, and quickly it became clear that this was definitely not the right gun. Let's start with the original ballistics report conducted before Aaron was listed as a suspect. One spent bullet and one bullet fragment were recovered from Saphiro Furtado's head during his autopsy. Another spent bullet was recovered from Aquilino Friere's forearm. Other ammunition was gathered at the crime scene the day after the shootings. A week after the shootings, Boston police conducted an analysis of the casings found at the crime scene, and the initial ballistics report came back showing some of the bullets could have been fired by a .357 Magnum, a .40 caliber semi-automatic, or a .38 Special. Now think about this for a second. As soon as Aaron becomes a suspect, Detective Sullivan puts out a notice to all police departments in the Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island tri-state area that they are looking for either a .357, .40, or .38 caliber gun. Just think of how many individual .357 guns there are in those three states. Then add that to all of the .40 caliber guns in those three states. Then add that to all of the .38 specials as well as .38 caliber guns in those three states as well. Can you imagine the astronomical odds of finding the one gun that matches the bullets fired into the BMW that night? Add these two little facts for good measure. It was the only gun confiscated and tested by the Boston Police Department, and it was found 3 days after naming Aaron Hernandez a suspect for a double murder that occurred a year earlier. These cops should not be working the beat. They should be playing lotto. What's unclear is how Detective Sullivan found the gun to begin with. In Florida, we have depositions in criminal cases, which give us the opportunity to ask officers under oath how they came about certain information. This is not the case in most states, Massachusetts included. Consider this. When a detective is looking for a particular gun, he enters the information he has into a statewide system and gets a list of all guns found on the streets, either at crime scenes or through arrests. Without a deposition, we don't know when Detective Sullivan entered his request, but by all indications, it was after Aaron became a suspect. On Magic Monday, a gun suddenly appears, and it was the only gun ever flagged. I still don't know when the Massachusetts State Police recovered this gun. How did they know to call Detective Sullivan? These were questions I intended to ask him on the stand, but oddly, prosecutors never called Detective Sullivan, the lead supervisor and detective in the case. Curiously enough, they called two detectives from his squad about other less important matters. It was the only gun ever recovered that was turned over to the Boston Police Department and the only gun ever tested by the Boston Firearms Analysis Unit. What's even crazier is that not a single witness ever identified the gun. Alexander Bradley, the Commonwealth's star witness, after being granted immunity, told the police he bought the murder weapon for Aaron and that it was a .357 Magnum. Bradley would later testify he had been dealing drugs for over a decade, was very familiar with guns, and owned a vast arsenal. As Bradley had been the one to buy this gun, logic would tell you that he knew the difference between a .357 Magnum and a .38 six-shooter. He also told police that after the Daniel De Abreu and Saphiro Furtado shootings, He and Aaron sped away in the Toyota 4Runner, and while driving down the turnpike on their way home, Bradley told Aaron, "You better get rid of that gun." According to Bradley, Aaron then took his shirt off, wiped the gun down, and threw it out the window into a wooded area. This occurred just outside of Boston, but somehow the gun miraculously made its way back to Aaron Hernandez's hometown of Bristol, Connecticut. Boston detectives also showed Bradley a picture